Stablecoins, systemic risk, and distributed networks. Three topics that might not seem connected, but they are, and they have implications for the opportunities and risks posed by the digital asset ecosystem. Today, we're going to explore the links between these three topics and more on Crypto Clarified. My name's Benjamin Dean. I'm a director in WisdomTree's digital asset team. Welcome back to the podcast. This is one where we examine the complex and fast-moving crypto space so you can navigate its opportunities and risks. Today, I'm joined by Austin Campbell, who's a consultant professor and writer and is an expert in market structure, risk management, and systems design in the crypto space. Before we start, US listeners, check out wisdomtreeprime.com and at the Apple or Android app stores. Hit subscribe and share on Spotify, YouTube, or iTunes. Please subscribe and share. And you can check me out on the Bird app at Benjamin Dean. Before we start, Sam, James, this is your shout out. It's everyone's favorite. Before I begin, I need to state the following. To clarify, the views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of WisdomTree and Austin Campbell and are subject to change. Anything we present in this podcast is not intended to be relied upon as a forecast, research, nor as investment or tax advice. The information and opinions expressed in this podcast are not a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any securities, and reliance upon them is at the sole discretion of the listener. Please remember that past performance is no indication of future results. All right, now we're going on to the fun stuff. Let's cut to the interview with Austin. All right, here we are with Austin Campbell. Austin, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Look, I've been looking forward to this, and it's going to be a great discussion, I'm sure. Please, just to kick things off, give the listeners a little bit of a feeling for you, your background, and why you and I are here speaking today.
Yeah, so I have a long winding road that led me to looking at the crypto space. I started my career, two decades ago now, so it's making me feel old. Back in reinsurance, actually, my first job was modeling terrorism risk, and that rapidly branched into all other kinds of disasters. So as I jokingly say, if it blows up, falls down, or kills people, I probably know something about it. I got from there into fixed income trading. I joined JP Morgan shortly after the financial crisis and ran a group called Insurance Linked Products. And that is a little bit of a misnomer because one of the main things that was in that group at JP Morgan was all of the cash stability products. So if anybody listening to this is familiar with stable value funds in the 401k space, I also know a lot more about that than is healthy, having done that for a decade. But I'll say something that will sound familiar to crypto people. If you had a large pool of bonds that participants needed to be able to trade in and out of at a pegged stable value over time, there may be much larger markets that already do that than stable coins. So from there, I ended up at a place called Stoneridge. They are NYDIG's parent, which is really where I started doing crypto seriously in 2018, right? Thinking about how do you lend Bitcoin through sort of traditional financial rails. And then after that, I was the co-head of essentially digital assets at Citi and Global Rates. And then I was at Paxos, where I ran all of the stable coins and was the CRO of one of our financial entities. Now, having escaped, I can say what I actually believe because I'm a professor at Columbia. I'm an adjunct in the business school there. And I also run my own consulting firm.
Very good. So we share a few things in common there. The first, catastrophic risk modeling. You got to do terrorism and hurricanes and things. I used to do cyber catastrophes.
Oh, okay. Excellent. We will have quite a bit to talk about. But
all right, great. Because of course, the cybersecurity thing, cyber catastrophe stuff is obviously like linked to the DeFi and the custody space and whatnot. So that's the first piece. The second piece is towards the end of your story. You're at Columbia now. I haunted the halls there. You might find my ghost somewhere in the business school, which was about 10 years ago when I was there, a fellow for cybersecurity. You and I would have run into each other if you had been there at the time, because the whole task was collating people who think about these kinds of interesting topics, like the intersection of technology, finance, geopolitics, you just name it. So it's really great to have you here today. And I'm sure the discussion will be interesting. And listeners know how much I love talking about stuff like this. So I hope they find it interesting as well. let's kick things off talking a bit about the term you just used, stablecoins, because it's something that you've worked a lot on. It's a term that I don't particularly like.
And we can go into why that's the case. But tell us a bit about your work with, experience with, and thoughts about stablecoins generally.
Yeah, so for one, I would agree with you. I think that term is grotesquely misused in the industry, if we're being totally honest, because when people say stablecoin, they say it with a level of specificity that is about the same as saying bond, right? Which is, while not completely useless, almost useless to communicate any information, right? So when I think about stablecoins, the definition I use in my course at Columbia is the representation of a unit of fiat currency on a blockchain. And what that means is, if you understand that, there's going to be good efforts at that, mediocre efforts at that, and tragically bad efforts at that, just like there are in the traditional financial world, if we're being honest. Most of my work in that space now is around defining what those categories are and communicating them effectively, because one of the key things I believe is I haven't seen anything in the stablecoin space in crypto that has not already been tried in traditional finance, right? Everything from extremely boring, like vanilla government money market fund type structures, all the way to the exact same sort of exotic financial products that some of my French quant friends built pre-crisis and blew up spectacularly. Like, apologies, but you guys know who you are. So the reality is we're just like kind of speed running the history of cash products in crypto and stepping on, quite frankly, many of the same landmines that were already stepped on in traditional finance. And
I think
they're useful. I think it's solvable, but we need to fix a lot of things.
Let's do people a service here and unpack those three categories, because I heard somebody the other day incorrectly term something an algorithmic stablecoin. And I hear this, and because I'm such a nerd, kind of my skin kind of crawls like, oh no, somebody doesn't understand what they're talking about. Unpack those three categories for people so that they can delineate in their own minds the differences between this terribly termed thing called stablecoins.
Yeah, so let's start with what I would define as good. I think there are two models there that have worked pretty successfully over time. One of which I have confidence will continue to work, one of which probably, but be careful. So category number one, things that basically look like government money market funds. So if you look at the 2008 crisis and the collapse of a lot of types of cash products like the reserve fund, which is prime money market funds, what you learn is that in a real crisis position, everybody flees to safety, and specifically flees to safety in short duration products. So what you want as the base layer of money, if you're using a, you know, some sort of debt instrument, is basically T-bills or what sounds like a weird instrument, but is actually a pretty simple instrument called overnight reverse repo, secured by, again, government securities, right? You're at the final layer of the financial system. If the government itself is defaulting, you have no expectation your US dollar stablecoin is going to continue to exist because the US dollar might be going. So this basically puts you one-to-one with the currency. And doing that in a very short duration, clean, boring, vanilla way worked through 2008. It also works in stablecoin space. So if you look at the properly constructed ones in that space, which I would suggest is largely the New York DFS regulated crowd, they've worked just fine. Like BUSD, when it was shut down, was able to go from 22.5-ish billion to basically low single-digit billions in pretty short order and had no issues. Like, this is doable. It is a solved problem. We should just do that. The other ones that historically have worked in this space is massively over-collateralized crypto stablecoins, right? So like the original version of DAI, call it, not what they're doing now over at Maker, but like if you gave me 4x Bitcoin and minted a stablecoin and you will liquidate as that ratio falls, that works pretty well. That is the equivalent in TradFi of a properly constructed AAA securitization. Right. So not the janky stuff, but like something that actually has a massive underlying pool of assets. Now, I would tell you that is more risky than the first category. Right. Bitcoin going to zero is more likely than the dollar completely annihilating, but both have some non-zero probability attached to them, which people don't like to talk about.
Yeah, fiat currencies die.
Exactly. And so I would tell you those two models, if you find them in the wild, if you're looking at the span of financial history for thousands of years, those have a track record of success. Now, as you leave that space and get into mediocre, I would say now we're into things more like either the less well-designed crypto collateralized stable coins, because if your collateral ratio is not large enough, everybody talks about capital efficiency, but the trade-off of capital efficiency is you're more likely to break. Yes, you move faster. Yes, it's easier to use, but also yes, it's less durable. This is the post-2008 argument about should banks hold more capital, like in the crypto space. And there are good arguments on both sides, but you need to understand the trade-off. The other thing I would say is in the mediocre bucket is all of the semi-properly designed fiat-backed stablecoins. So in there, I would put historically both Circle and Tether, right? Because as you look at good products in the like TradFi space, it needs to have clear reserve guidelines that are externally enforceable. It needs to be bankruptcy remote. There need to be guarantees of redemption and timeliness. Yeah. And while those products have T's and C's that cover bits and pieces of that, they do not give you the same rights as somebody who holds, say, a government money market fund in 40 Act format or like a guaranteed investment contract from certain insurance companies. There are better ways to do it. So I regard those as like good effort, but you can improve if we're being totally honest for the fiat-backed crowd. And okay, now let's descend several stairs down into the bad category.
There's more stairs?
Oh, there are so many more stairs. Like it stairs all the way down. And somewhere like literally the bottom of the pile is UST, but we'll come back to that. So as you get down the stairs, I would say now you run into things that definitely are not going to work in the long run. So apologies to all of the fans in advance, but like the current iteration of MakerDAO is a good example of that. When you are YOLOing into private credit and do not have a large capital buffer and do not have complete transparency into what is going on, it is a matter of time until you end up holding a live grenade, right? That is just a statement about credit markets. That is not an attack on any specific person, but the reality is defaults happen. And if you have a significant default in your fiat-backed stablecoin, it is not stable anymore. That is how credit works. So I would say models like that are not going to end well. In the same vein, a lot of the like, call it hybrid stable coins that are trying to do like some degree of collateralization, but maybe some like project token that reserves or something, these are going to end badly, right? Like maybe the best example of that was Iron Finance, if people remember that one, which was partially collateralized with USDC, but partially collateralized with the project token. And as it turns out, when the project token turns down, you're under reserved, buy. That's how a lot of those are going to end. The last ones are the ones that are entirely self-referential systems. So that was like UST, right? And, you know, the great tragedy of that is the core thinking originally was, let's have a large, diversified, uncorrelated, unrelated base of economic activity and then create a stablecoin on top of it. There's actually a chance that might work. But what they actually did was none of that and just built Anchor Protocol and then bridged it everywhere in DeFi so that you had a stablecoin that rested entirely on top of the stablecoin holding the peg. And that sort of self-referential system is always going to implode given enough time.
You just said UST could, you know, is an interesting concept in theory. I'm paraphrasing. When I looked at that, I remarked the same thing to one of my colleagues. I said, that's an interesting idea. And they've just failed and no one will touch it now for years. But could you just delve a little bit into why you think it's a good idea? Because maybe there's a hint of something in the future hiding there that isn't obvious to people.
Yeah. So zooming out, like, the core idea behind it is just what is money? So like, let me describe both the original idea of UST and literally the US dollar. There is a large diversified pool of real economic activity where people are doing things every day, all day with their hands and generating value. And on top of that, we're going to abstract it away and create a generic unit of exchange between all of these people that they can use to pay for things. Like, this is literally just the concept of money so that we're not using the freaking barter system to like do everything. Okay. And the problem with UST was rather than embracing that ethos, which would have meant both growing much more slowly, being more cautious about the kinds of ways in which they deployed, and here's the real kicker, probably making a lot less money for the VCs and the project team as they did this. You could have built something that worked. Because, like, let me propose the thought experiment of UST writ large, okay?
Right.
Let's say that instead of just using Luna, we somehow, and obviously this is never going to happen, so this is a real thought experiment, we somehow were able to take Bitcoin or Ethereum or tokenized gold and take a dollar of that and convert it into the stablecoin, or take the stablecoin and convert it back into a dollar of those things, right? Just as a thought experiment. And more so, we said that the amount of stablecoins outstanding could only ever be a fraction of the total market cap of all of those things, so you never have the tail wagging the dog. I would suggest to you that stablecoin would definitely hold its peg and be durable over time. The problem is you have a starting problem with how to do that on something that's scaled, and another problem of how do you define too much and then hold people to it, which is, again, getting to part of why most currencies are inflationary.
I was going to ask why you couldn't do it. I mean, I always appreciate thought experiments, but the Bitcoin exists, Ether exists, gold, tokenized gold exists. I mean, you've just outlined a couple of impediments, but is there anything else I'm missing there? Because theoretically you could do it, but I can also see a way in which you could do it in practice these days.
I think the problem would be getting all of those communities to adopt that idea simultaneously and then putting guardrails around it such that we have a collective, like, stable definition of what is enough of the stablecoin. Like, is it theoretically possible? Yes. I think I'm saying, is the coordination problem insurmountable in the current world? Probably also yes.
It doesn't sound that different from special drawer rights. In a way, a basket of different currencies that are meant to kind of balance each other out, in inverted commas.
Though yes, we know and I, course, but I defy you to go convince the Bitcoin core devs to do that.
Well, we could always try.
Right. I'm not saying it's not an idea that could eventually emerge. I mean, this is some of the same thinking behind, like, Libra and Diem. Right. I don't think it's impossible. I just think functionally, when you try to introduce that to the real world, the friction is very, very big to actually get it.
Okay.
Right. But I define those boundaries to show people where the problems are and to tell them you should be very skeptical of an algo stablecoin unless they have actually done all these extremely hard things to make it work.
Now, I'm reading this excellent book. Have you read this one before? Profiles of the Future.
Arthur C. Clarke. Yes.
Yeah. Good. You know, he talks about the difference between things that are possible theoretically and things that are literally impossible because the limits of what you can do.
Yeah. No, here I would say, I think this is theoretically possible, just very, very hard, but short-term impossible because of the overhang from UST.
All right. That's fine. That's fine. Let's move on. Hey, you've just done a great panorama of stablecoins and all their different manifestations over time, their strengths and weaknesses, and even hinted at, like, what something better in the future might look like. To kind of step back a bit, so if we've got this traditional finance system, which this kind of new system maps onto, why do we need this new system? What is it about this new technology that is beneficial or value add over just running on the old system?
All right. So the only people who are going to truly enjoy this segment are going to be other really grouchy fixed income traders, but shout out to
good. There's plenty of them in the audience.
Excellent. So I would say I got into blockchain not through ideology, but through looking at a lot of the stuff that broke in 2008 and a lot of the things that just gave me heartburn on the trading desk at JPM every day. And so I put the value of blockchain into three different categories. Category one is just the ability to literally find stuff. Like, if you look at the traditional financial system, it is incredibly fragmented. If I repo a bond over to UBS and then UBS rehypothecates it onward, sometimes unraveling that chain is nightmarish. Like, when I recall that thing, it's 30 layers down at some asset manager and who knows where. And by the way, went through Morgan Stanley like 5 times in a bunch of different transactions. Like, this literally happens, okay? And it takes 15 seconds with a block explorer to find that thing, and it takes forever playing phone tag in the traditional system to find these things sometimes. So one is just visibility into the system, which, if you have that, actually solves a lot of problems. Number two, counterparty credit risk. So one of the things I hate about the current system is the inability to do instant settlement, and that is not an endorsement of instant settlement at all times. There are sometimes legitimate reasons for delayed settlement. Batching, right? Like operational efficiency by netting at the end of the day. Like there are real reasons that you may not always want it, but sometimes you do, right? Great example. It would be very easy to keep trading spot with Lehman in 2008 if you could settle T instant instead of T plus two. You would not have been exposed to their bankruptcy risk. You could have just kept doing spot markets nonstop at all times. And so I think a system where you could have decentralized instantaneous clearing. So now we've gotten rid of the reliance on a centralized entity to do the clearing. You can just drop a smart contract. I put in, let's go back, a good stable coin. You put in a tokenized bond. It releases to both sides. Our trade is cleared. Excellent. Like that sort of upgrade to the system is actually a strict upgrade. And if you want me to call out where I think regulators have the most like skin in the game in crypto and have failed the most so far, it's understanding the implications of that specific detail. Like many of the things still giving us heartburn from 08 can be solved almost instantly with blockchains once you get what's really going on under the hood. So the third part of all of this is what I would call, like, I'll be polite and say group supervision, but what I actually mean is seeing who the dumb person is. And what I mean by that is when you're using a blockchain, if everybody is using pseudonyms, you still can get a good idea of aggregate positions at various places. So if in 08, I'm watching the market and going, wow, why has this one wallet address sold 50% of the CDS in the world? I have questions. Unless that's the Federal Reserve, I'm quite alarmed. I would think that things like the AIG CDS problem would have been less severe had we been doing all of that on a blockchain, because many people would have been able to see in advance, oh, these guys are way overdone. I don't want to add to that problem, right? And so when you have a little bit more transparency through, you know, pseudonyms, essentially, as people trade, I don't need to know specifically it's AIG. I just need to know maybe I want to avoid that CDS market and find a different hedge, that you're going to end up with better and more effective risk management. This is a point Nassim Taleb makes some, you know, in some of his writing, where systems that hide the volatility because you can't see it tend to build up a lot of problems and have a large break at the finish line. A better system actually has lots of small to medium level volatility all the time so that you can see it, stress test the system. I think blockchains push you towards that world, which although in the short term, it makes you ride a little bumpier and people will dislike that. In the long run, it makes you ride a lot less bumpy because you don't have the giant fall off a cliff at the finish line.
Okay. Let's extend those thoughts a little bit more, because I appreciate all the kind of the benefits, both potential and actual, you've pointed out. You've also pointed out some shortcomings. In times that I've spoken to people who are responsible for monitoring financial stability, one of the things that they point at is kind of the dominance of certain actors within the space. They become central points of failure in these people's eyes. One that they pointed at is like certain networks becoming the dominant network. And if something goes wrong, and enough people are reliant upon that network, then you've introduced a new source of catastrophic risk, essentially. Yeah, let's you and I just kind of run through those different pieces, because with new technology, there's always pros and cons. Otherwise, you know, we'd be in utopia already, which is actually dystopia if you read the original book. But setting that aside, let's run through some of the other pieces there, because central points of failure, new ones, is interesting. Technology failure at scale is interesting. We talk all the time on the show about bugs in the software layer, but I'm interested in your thoughts, because you're somebody obviously spends a lot of time thinking about this. What do you think?
So I would say a lot of that question, or there are many questions in there, but I would start with the central premise of it depends what we mean by moving onto a blockchain to handle a lot of these things. That is to say, do we literally mean using one blockchain that has the current properties of something like Bitcoin, which is like, call it irrevocable and permanent? Or do we mean something perhaps different? Because like, let me actually give some examples of things that exist in the wild, okay?
Sure.
So one is literally Bitcoin. We know a lot about that. I'll just lay it out there as one example. Another good example would be Ethereum, proof of stake, smart contract tooling. But again, it's still a pretty permanent thing. Like when there's bugs, it just kind of deals with the bugs, so to speak. But another example of that would be something like, say, Stellar, right? Which is a, call it proof of consensus that is more based on, call it social quality and people behaving by the rules. So I would say Bitcoin and Ethereum very much kind of subscribe to the code is law viewpoint of how the world works. And I would tell you that Stellar is much closer to a principles-based regulation, where I would expect there, if there's a giant bug that's a, you know, if we tokenized everything, misappropriates all of JP Morgan's bonds, they're not going to be like, yeah, that's cool, you get to keep it. They're probably just going to give all the bonds back, right? So the question for me is, in many ways, one, how do you design your system? Because how you resolve bugs is a decision, right? The statement of the current networks of essentially whatever goes, goes is actually a decision on bug resolution. And there are other decisions that could be made. I would say another point that's very important is I would never, ever, ever, ever advise people in the financial world to use only one type of blockchain. Like, that is a path to disaster. You need multiple redundancy. One of my big complaints with the current system is that we did not have that, right? Like, you actually need more layers. Don't use a blockchain, use many blockchains. And if one is down, have some sort of dynamic rerouting to the others. We need a way to have systems that are multiply redundant. And then I think a final point on that one is there's a lot we also need to think about with token standards in this space. And I think about that a lot more as somebody who's done fiat-backed stablecoins. But things like permissioning, transaction reversibility, like whitelist, blacklist, freeze and seize capabilities, error catching, even if that's not at the base layer in a network, because in some networks, there's a good reason for it not to be there. You can put it into token standards and achieve a lot of these same things. And I think that has really been an under-discussed point of how this architecture fits together, right? Because if you, again, on ETH, have a hack that involves USDP as the guy who ran it at Paxos, and it ends up in the hands of a bad actor, guess what? I can unilaterally take that right back out of your wallet.
Yeah, well, you know that from experience, and so do I. It's something we think very deeply about. It's one of the reasons I throw a fit when somebody uses the term permissioned blockchain. And
all blockchains are in one form or another, both permissioned and not, right? Like that kind of like stablecoin, that's a meaningless term right now.
Yeah. And it totally misses the point, as you were pointing out, that like the permissions are put in at the contract or kind of the software layer that sits between the applications and the base protocol. Anyway, we could go on all day about it, but yes, like that, they are serious things. And if you get it right, you can start unlocking a lot of potential and mitigate the risks. But if you get it wrong, big trouble. So that's why I've got people to think about it carefully.
Well, I think you've hit on two things that are very important to kind of the debate around crypto as we breach into the mainstream right now. So one is the idea of making sure we manage our definitions carefully and draw the right analogies. I think why permissioned blockchains have been seductive to a lot of people is that it is just recreating the current system, but with a blockchain, right? Like when you have a bank, you go to the bank, you bring 80 pages of documentation. You try to open an account. Invariably, they tell you no or screw it up the first time. You come back with more paperwork and eventually maybe it works. Okay. Like this is the standard process for opening a bank account. And then once you're in, you can kind of do whatever you want as long as you're not tripping some pretty egregious things. Like if I'm just putting in, you know, some amount of money every day, they don't ask me, where did it come from? What have you done? Let me see like substantiation, right? If I put in $500 million, yeah, they're going to ask, but like small amounts, no, you can just deposit that in ATMs forever. Okay, fine. However, that system is based on like this permissioning idea that happens because of like that initial hard boundary and then a very soft interior that's fragmented. When your system works the other way, that is to say, an open boundary. It's easier for people to get in, but way more visibility of what's happening inside. Simply recreating the old way of doing things is probably value subtracted. So it's important to explain, you're making this analogy because you see it in the real world, but these are not one-to-one. Like I hear a lot, same activity, same rules, but the reality is it's not the same activity, right? Like if I deposit money at JP Morgan, JP Morgan doesn't know the entire transaction history of those dollars before it got to JP Morgan, but on a blockchain you do. that is not the same activity, right? One, they have a lot more visibility. And I think understanding that implication is really important. Number two, in the policy debate, people are very scared about illicit finance because of like the pseudonymous nature of blockchains. But I think the problem that they misunderstand is, again, the current system has problems with that because of how fragmented it is. So to, again, take a TradFi example, let's talk about how money laundering actually happens. So I, an American, send money to a relative who lives in what I'm going to call a neutral jurisdiction. So I'm just going to pick the Bahamas because it's nearby. No insult to the Bahamas. You're literally just close. That's why I picked you. The person in the Bahamas spends it at a business. That business turns out to have been owned by somebody who's sympathetic to Hamas. So they pay a dividend to that person who then gives the money to Hamas. And that business is probably, to be super annoying, what I would call a semi-legitimate business. That is to say, it does some real business, but also launders money. High markups, fake transactions, like all the stuff that makes it hard to find. This is an actual canonical path of money laundering. That's how that works. So here's the hard part in TradFi. I, the American, sent a wire to a relative. So that could go literally from like Chase to HSBC. All of the rest of that transaction stack, Chase has no visibility into. They don't know what happens with the money going to the business. They don't know about the dividend to the owner. They don't know about the transfer down the road. The system is siloed. It is fragmented. In crypto, even though people are using pseudonyms, you can see every hop of that stack. It's actually much better than TradFi in the information that you have. And so the original sender could see, hey, five hops later, this money is in a Hamas wallet. And then you can start unwinding that transaction stack to figure out how it happened. Whereas in TradFi, that's all beneath the surface. You don't even know what happened. And that's why people still prefer it for money laundering. So again, not the same activity. You don't want the same rules. You can think harder about it and actually build a better mousetrap. And this is really where we've gotten into trouble in this space, is not understanding the differences.
Yeah, I see a lot of that. You've done me a massive favor by explaining that. Because I've spent years doing this. But maybe someone will listen, finally.
I'll say, I'm going to give the optimistic view. I think people now, like literally this year, are starting to listen, right? This year, I have seen a change in tenor of discussions to actually get more sophisticated on the policy and regulatory side.
Excellent. That is good to hear. And I'm glad that we can be optimistic about something, because it's been a long time coming. But you have to be very patient, this kind of stuff. However, we are coming up on time, Austin, and we finish up these episodes thinking about the future. You and I can riff a bit on this. What's got your eye at the moment? What do you think is interesting that other people, listeners, should be keeping an eye on as well?
So I think we've hit the point where there are now credible enough stable coins emerging in the world that they are going to start to be integrated into real-world payments applications. And that has the implication of creating a low-fee global rail for dollars or whatever else we tokenize that is going to help the horrible fragmentation in like international correspondence and FX markets, right? Now I will be able to send money as a merchant from Thailand to a vendor in Finland for like 1 cent as the fee. That is a huge upgrade. And I think things like PayPal's US dollar are going to be the key there. Like, what people don't realize in crypto is the real world side of this is often the harder part. So having something that is tokenized that can also then be integrated with the PayPal app and like used easily on people's phones in the exact way they already use it, that is a very big unlock. And so to me, it is the breaching of these things into what I would call also Web 2 companies, and starting to get to interoperability with the old rails that will allow the gravitational pull to bring more things onto a blockchain. So I'm very excited about that for the next year, like 3 to 5 years. The other thing I would say is financial markets transformation is both way slower than people think, but way more impactful than people think in the long run.
They're two good ones there. I agree with you on both of them. We keep a close eye on them. The one that's got my eye at the moment is kind of zero knowledge proofs used as a way to obscure information flows. Going back to your last point, and not in our closing segment, but around traceability of these networks, it is now possible with the technology out of the box to obscure these trails. And I don't think anybody's really worked it out in the sense of like, it's here. I've been looking at it for years and just spending my time on it this last month or so. It's here. And people have got to wrap their heads around that. So I don't know what that's worth to you, but the listeners, I hope, find it useful and interesting. But that's it, Austin. It's time to finish up. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been an excellent discussion.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And there you have it, folks. Austin Campbell, adjunct professor at Columbia Business School. US listeners, WisdomTree Prime, check it out, wisdomtreeprime.com. Check me out on the Bird app, and Austin's on the Bird app as well. He's very active, very interesting, so go check him out. Thanks very much for listening, folks. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next time.